that Ukifune had disappeared, last seen heading toward a river. She had most likely committed suicide. At the funeral ceremony for Ukifune, Kaoru was racked with guilt. Why had he not come for her earlier? She deserved a better fate. Kaoru and the others appear in the 11th century Japanese novel, The Tale of Genji, by the noblewoman Murasaki Shikibu. The characters are based on people the author knew, but Kaoru's type appears in every culture and period. These are men and women who seem to be searching for an ideal partner. The one they have is never quite right. At first glance, a person excites them, but they soon see faults, and when a new person crosses their path, he or she looks better, and the first person is forgotten. These types often try to work on the imperfect mortal who has excited them, to improve them culturally and morally. But this proves extremely unsatisfactory for both parties. The truth about this type is not that they are searching for an ideal, but that they are hopelessly unhappy with themselves. You may mistake their dissatisfaction for a perfectionist's high standards, but in point of fact, nothing will really satisfy them, for their unhappiness is deep-rooted. You can recognize them by their past, which will be littered with short-lived, stormy romances. Also, they will tend to compare you to others and to try to remake you. You may not realize at first what you've gotten into, but people like this will eventually prove hopelessly anti-seductive, because they cannot see your individual qualities. Cut the romance off before it happens. These types are closet sadists and will torture you with their unreachable goals. 5. In 1762, in the city of Turin, Italy, Giovanni Giacomo Casanova made the acquaintance of one Count A.B., a Milanese gentleman who seemed to like him enormously. The Count had fallen on hard times, and Casanova lent him some money. In gratitude, the Count invited Casanova to stay with him and his wife in Milan. His wife, he said, was from Barcelona, and was admired far and wide for her beauty. He showed Casanova her letters, which had an intriguing wit. Casanova imagined her as a prize worth seducing. He went to Milan. Arriving at the house of Count A.B., Casanova found that the Spanish lady was certainly beautiful, but that she was also quiet and serious. Something about her bothered him. As he was unpacking his clothes, the Countess saw a stunning red dress, trimmed with sable, among his belongings. It was a gift, Casanova explained, for any Milanese lady who won his heart. The following evening at dinner, the Countess was suddenly more friendly, teasing and bantering with Casanova. She described the dress as a bribe. He would use it to persuade a woman to give in to him. On the contrary, said Casanova, he only gave gifts afterward as tokens of his appreciation. That evening, in a carriage on the way back from the opera, she asked him if a wealthy friend of hers could buy the dress, and when he said no, she was clearly vexed. Sensing her game, Casanova offered to give her the sable dress if she was kind to him. This only made her angry, and they quarreled. Finally, Casanova had had enough of the Countess's moods. He sold the dress for 15,000 francs to her wealthy friend, who in turn gave it to her, as she had planned all along. But to prove his lack of interest in money, Casanova told the Countess he would give her the 15,000 francs, no strings attached. "You are a very bad man," she said, "but you can stay. You amuse me." She resumed her coquettish manner, but Casanova was not fooled. "It is not my fault, madame, if your charms have so little power over me," he told her. "Here are 15,000 francs to console you." He laid the money on a table and walked out, leaving the Countess fuming and vowing revenge. When Casanova first met the Spanish lady, two things about her repelled him. First, her pride. Rather than engaging in the give and take of seduction, she demanded a man's subjugation. Pride can reflect self-assurance, signaling that you will not abase yourself before others. Just as often, though, it stems from an inferiority complex, which demands that others abase themselves before you. Seduction requires an openness to the other person, a willingness to bend and adapt. Excessive pride, without anything to justify it, is highly anti-seductive. The second quality that disgusted Casanova was the Countess's greed. Her coquettish little games were designed only to get the dress. She had no interest in romance. For Casanova, seduction was a light-hearted game that people played for their mutual amusement. In his scheme of things, it was fine if a woman wanted money and gifts as well. He could understand that desire, and he was a generous man. But he also felt that this was a desire a woman should disguise. She should create the impression that what she was after was pleasure. The person who is obviously angling for money or other material reward can only repel. If that is your intention, if you are looking for something other than pleasure, for money, for power, never show it. The suspicion of an ulterior motive is anti-seductive. Never let anything break the illusion. 6. In 1868, Queen Victoria of England hosted her first private meeting with the country's new Prime Minister, William Gladstone. She had met him before and knew his reputation as a moral absolutist, but this was to be a ceremony, an exchange of pleasantries. Gladstone, however, had no patience for such things. At that first meeting, he explained to the Queen his theory of royalty. The Queen, he believed, had to play an exemplary role in England, a role she had lately failed to live up to, for she was overly private. This lecture set a bad tone for the future, and things only got worse. Soon Victoria was receiving letters from Gladstone addressing the subject in even greater depth. Half of them she never bothered to read, and soon she was doing everything she could to avoid contact with the leader of her government. If she had to see him, she made the meeting as brief as possible. To that end, she never allowed him to sit down in her presence, hoping that a man his age would soon tire and leave. For once he got going on a subject dear to his heart, he did not notice your look of disinterest or the tears in your eyes from yawning. His memoranda on even the simplest of issues would have to be translated into plain English for her by a member of her staff. Worst of all, Gladstone argued with her, and his arguments had a way of making her feel stupid. She soon learned to nod her head and appear to agree with whatever abstract point he was trying to make. In a letter to her secretary, referring to herself in the third person, she wrote, "She always felt in Gladstone's manner an overbearing obstinacy and imperiousness which she never experienced from anyone else, and which she found most disagreeable." Over the years, these feelings hardened into an unwaning hatred. As the head of the Liberal Party, Gladstone had a nemesis, Benjamin Disraeli, the head of the Conservative Party. He considered Disraeli amoral, a devilish Jew. At one session of Parliament, Gladstone tore into his rival, scoring point after point as he described where his opponent's policies would lead. Growing angry as he spoke, as usually happened when he talked of Disraeli, he pounded the speaker's table with such force that pens and papers went flying. Through all this, Disraeli seemed half asleep. When Gladstone had finished, he opened his eyes, rose to his feet, and calmly walked up to the table. "The Right Honorable Gentleman," he said, "has spoken with much passion, much eloquence, and much, violence." Then, after a drawn-out pause, he continued, "But the damage can be repaired." And he proceeded to gather up everything that had fallen from the table and put them back in place. The speech that followed was all the more masterful for its calm and ironic contrast to Gladstone's. The members of Parliament were spellbound, and all of them agreed he had won the day. If Disraeli was the consummate social seducer and charmer, Gladstone was the anti-seducer. Of course, he had supporters, mostly among the more puritanical elements of society. He twice defeated Disraeli in a general election, but he found it hard to broaden his appeal beyond the circle of believers. Women in particular found him insufferable. Of course, they had no vote at the time, so they were little political liability. But Gladstone had no patience for a feminine point of view. A woman, he felt, had to learn to see things as a man did, and it was his purpose in life to educate those he felt were irrational or abandoned by God. It did not take long for Gladstone to wear on anyone's nerves. That is the nature of people who are convinced of some truth, but have no patience for a different perspective or for dealing with someone else's psychology. These types are bullies, and in the short term they often get their way, particularly among the less aggressive, but they stir up a lot of resentment and unspoken antipathy, which eventually trips them up. People see through their righteous moral stance, which is most often a cover for a power play. Morality is a form of power. A seducer never seeks to persuade directly, never parades his or her immorality, never lectures or imposes. Everything is subtle, psychological, and indirect. Uses of anti-seduction. The best way to avoid entanglements with anti-seducers is to recognize them right away and give them a wide berth, but they often deceive us. Involvements with these types are painful and are hard to disengage from because the more emotional response you show, the more engaged you seem to be. Don't get angry. That may only encourage them or exacerbate their anti-seductive tendencies. Instead, act distant and indifferent. Pay no attention to them. Make them feel how little they matter to you. The best antidote to an anti-seducer is often to be anti-seductive yourself. Cleopatra had a devastating effect on every man who crossed her path. Octavius, the future Emperor Augustus, and the man who would defeat and destroy Cleopatra's lover, Mark Antony, was well aware of her power and defended himself against it by being always extremely amiable with her, courteous to the extreme, but never showing the slightest emotion, whether of interest or dislike. In other words, he treated her as if she were any other woman. Facing this front, she could not sink her hooks into him. Octavius made anti-seduction his defense against the most irresistible woman in history. Remember, seduction is a game of attention, of slowly filling the other person's mind with your presence. Distance and inattention will create the opposite effect and can be used as a tactic when the need arises. Finally, if you really want to anti-seduce, simply feign the qualities listed at the beginning of the chapter. Nag. Talk a lot, particularly about yourself. Dress against the other person's tastes. Pay no attention to detail. Suffocate, and so on. A word of warning. With the arguing type, the windbag, never talk back too much. Words will only fan the flames. Adopt the Queen Victoria strategy. Nod. Seem to agree. Then find an excuse to cut the conversation short. This is the only defense. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on the anti-seducer. A quote from The Book of the Courtier by Baldassare Castiglione. Count Lodovico then remarked with a smile, "I promise you that our sensible courtier will never act so stupidly to gain a woman's favor." Cesare Gonzaga replied, "Nor so stupidly as a gentleman I remember of some repute, whom, to spare men's blushes, I don't wish to mention by name." "Well, at least tell us what he did," said the Duchess. Then Cesare continued, "He was loved by a very great lady, and at her request he came secretly to the town where she was. After he had seen her and enjoyed her company for as long as she would let him in the time, He sighed and wept bitterly to show the anguish he was suffering at having to leave her, and he begged her never to forget him. And then he added that she should pay for his lodging at the inn, since it was she who had sent for him, and he thought it only right, therefore, that he shouldn't be involved in any expense over the journey. At this, all the ladies began to laugh, and to say that the man concerned hardly deserved the name of gentleman, and many of the men felt as ashamed as he should have been, had he ever had the sense to recognize such disgraceful behavior for what it was. A quotation from How Love is Diminished by Andreas Kapayanis. Let us see now how love is diminished. This happens through the easy accessibility of its consolations, through one's being able to see and converse lengthily with a lover, through a lover's unsuitable garb and gait, and by the sudden onset of poverty. Another cause of diminution of love is the realization of the notoriety of one's lover, and accounts of his miserliness, bad character, and general wickedness. Also, any affair with another woman, even if it involves no feelings of love. Love is also diminished if a woman realizes that her lover is foolish and undiscerning, or if she sees him going too far in demands of love, giving no thought to his partner's modesty, nor wishing to pardon her blushes. A faithful lover ought to choose the harshest pains of love, rather than by his demands cause his partner embarrassment, or take pleasure in spurning her modesty. For one who thinks only of the outcome of his own pleasure and ignores the welfare of his partner should be called a traitor rather than a lover. Love also suffers decrease if the woman realizes that her lover is fearful in war, or sees that he has no patience, or is stained with the vice of pride. There is nothing which appears more appropriate to the character of any lover than to be clad in the adornment of humility, utterly untouched by the nakedness of pride. Then, too, the prolixity of a fool or a madman often diminishes love. There are many keen to prolong their crazy words in the presence of a woman, thinking that they please her if they employ foolish, ill-judged language. But in fact, they are strangely deceived. Indeed, he who thinks that his foolish behavior pleases a wise woman suffers from the greatest poverty of sense. A quotation from Ovid's The Art of Love. Real men shouldn't primp their good looks. Keep pleasantly clean. Take exercise. Work up an outdoor tan. Make quite sure that your toga fits and doesn't show spots. Don't lace your shoes too tightly or ignore any rusty buckles or slop around in too large a fitting. Don't let some incompetent barber ruin your looks. Both hair and beard demand expert attention. Keep your nails pared and dirt-free. Don't let those long hairs sprout in your nostrils. Make sure your breath is never offensive. Avoid the rank male stench that wrinkles noses. I was about to warn you, women, against rank goatish armpits and bristling hair on your legs, but I'm not instructing hillbilly girls from the Caucasus or Michigan River hoydens. So what need to remind you not to let your teeth get all discolored through neglect or forget to wash your hands every morning? You know how to brighten your complexion with powder, add rouge to a bloodless face, skillfully block in the crude outline of an eyebrow, stick a patch on one flawless cheek. You don't shrink from lining your eyes with dark mascara or a touch of Sicilian saffron. But don't let your lover find all those jars and bottles on your dressing table. The best makeup remains unobtrusive. A face so thickly plastered with pancake it runs down your sweaty neck is bound to create repulsion. And that goo from unwashed fleeces, Athenian maybe, but my dear, the smell, that's used for face cream. Avoid it. When you have company, don't dab stuff on your pimples. Don't start cleaning your teeth. The result may be attractive, but the process is sickening. A quote from Eastern Love, Volume 2, The Harlot's Breviary of Kshmendra. But if, like the winter cat upon the hearth, the lover clings when he is dismissed and cannot bear to go, certain means must be taken to make him understand, and these should be progressively ruder and ruder until they touch him to the quick of his flesh. She should refuse him the bed and jeer at him and make him angry. She should stir up her mother's enmity against him. She should treat him with an obvious lack of candor and spread herself in long considerations about his ruin. His departure should be openly anticipated. His tastes and desires should be thwarted, his poverty outraged. She should let him see that she is in sympathy with another man. She should blame him with harsh words on every occasion. She should tell lies about him to her parasites. She should interrupt his sentences and send him on frequent errands away from the house. She should seek occasions of quarrel and make him the victim of 1,000 domestic perfidies. She should rack her brains to vex him. She should play with the glances of another in his presence and give herself up to reprehensible profligacy before his face. She should leave the house as often as possible and let it be seen that she has no real need to do so. All these means are good for showing a man the door. A quote from Seigneur de Brantôme's Lives of Fair and Gallant Ladies. Just as ladies do love men which be valiant and bold under arms, so likewise do they love such as be of like sort in love. And the man which is cowardly and over and above respectful toward them will never win their good favor. Not that they would have them so overweening, bold, and presumptuous as that they should by main force lay them on the floor, but rather they desire in them a certain hardy modesty, or perhaps better, a certain modest hardihood. For while themselves are not exactly wantons, and will neither solicit a man nor yet actually offer their favors, yet do they know well how to rouse the appetites and passions, and prettily allure to the skirmish in such wise that he which doth not take occasion by the forelock and join encounter, and that without the least awe of rank and greatness, without a scruple of conscience or a fear of any sort of hesitation, he verily is a fool and a spiritless poltroon, and one which doth merit to be forever abandoned of kind fortune. I have heard of two honorable gentlemen and comrades, for the which two very honorable ladies, and of by no means humble quality, made tryst one day at Paris to go walking in a garden. Being come thither, each lady did separate apart one from the other, each alone with her own cavalier, each in a several alley of the garden, that was so close covered in with a fair trellis of boughs as that daylight could really scarce penetrate there at all, and the coolness of the place was very grateful. Now one of the twain was a bold man, and well knowing how the party had been made for something else than merely to walk and take the air, and judging by his lady's face, which he saw to be all afire, that she had longings to taste other fare than the muscatels that hung on the trellis, and also by her hot, wanton, and wild speech, he did promptly seize on so fair an opportunity. So, catching hold of her without the least ceremony, he did lay her on a little couch that was there made of turf and clods of earth, and did very pleasantly work his will of her, without her ever uttering a word, but only, "Heavens! Sir, what are you at? Surely you be the maddest and strangest fellow ever was. If anyone comes, whatever will they say? Great heavens, get out!" But the gentleman, without disturbing himself, did so well continue what he had begun that he did finish, and she to boot, with such content as that after taking 3 or 4 turns up and down the alley, they did presently start afresh. Anon, coming forth into another open alley, they did see in another part of the garden the other pair, who were walking about together, just as they had left them at first. whereupon the lady, well content, did say to the gentleman in the like condition, I verily believe so-and-so hath played the silly prude, and hath given his lady no other entertainment but only words, fine speeches, and promenading. Afterward, when all four were come together, the two ladies did fall to asking one another how it had fared with each. Then the one which was well content did reply, she was exceeding well, indeed she was, indeed for the nonce she could scarce be better. The other, which was ill content, did declare for her part, she had had to do with the biggest fool and most coward lover she had ever seen. And all the time the two gentlemen could see them laughing together as they walked and crying out, oh, the silly fool, the shamefaced poltroon and coward. At this, the successful gallant said to his companion, hark to our ladies, which do cry out at you and mock you sore. You will find you have overplayed the prude and coxcomb this bout. So much did he allow, but there was no more time to remedy his error, for opportunity gave him no other handle to seize her by. The Seducer's Victims, the 18 Types. The people around you are all potential victims of a seduction. But first you must know what type of victim you're dealing with. Victims are categorized by what they feel they are missing in life. Adventure, attention, romance, a naughty experience, mental or physical stimulation, etc. Once you identify their type, you have the necessary ingredients for a seduction. You will be the one to give them what they lack and cannot get on their own. In studying potential victims, learn to see the reality behind the appearance. A timid person may yearn to play the star. A prude may long for a transgressive thrill. Never try to seduce your own type. Victim theory. Nobody in this world feels whole and complete. We all sense some gap in our character, something we need or want but cannot get on our own. When we fall in love, it is often with someone who seems to fill that gap. The process is usually unconscious and depends on luck. We wait for the right person to cross our path, and when we fall for them, we hope they return our love. But the seducer doesn't leave such things to chance. Look at the people around you. Forget their social exterior, their obvious character traits. Look behind all of that, focusing on the gaps, the missing pieces in their psyche. That is the raw material of any seduction. Pay close attention to their clothes, their gestures, their offhand comments, the things in their house, certain looks in their eyes. Get them to talk about their past, particularly past romances. And slowly, the outline of those missing pieces will come into view. Understand, people are constantly giving out signals as to what they lack. They long for completeness, whether the illusion of it or the reality. And if it has to come from another person, that person has tremendous power over them. We may call them victims of a seduction, but they are almost always willing victims. This chapter outlines the 18 types of victims, each one of which has a dominant lack. Although your target may well reveal the qualities of more than one type, there is usually a common need that ties them together. Perhaps you see someone as both a new prude and a crushed star, but what is common to both is a feeling of repression, and therefore a desire to be naughty, along with a fear of not being able or daring enough. In identifying your victim's type, be careful to not be taken in by outward appearances. Both deliberately and unconsciously, we often develop a social exterior designed specifically to disguise our weaknesses and lacks. For instance, you may think you are dealing with someone who's tough and cynical, without realizing that deep inside, they have a soft, sentimental core. They secretly pine for romance. And unless you identify their type and the emotions beneath their toughness, you lose the chance to truly seduce them. Most important, expunge the nasty habit of thinking that other people have the same lacks you do. You may crave comfort and security, but in giving comfort and security to someone else, on the assumption they must want them as well, you are more likely smothering and pushing them away. Never try to seduce someone who is of your own type. You will be like two puzzles missing the same parts. The 18 types. The reformed rake or siren. People of this type were once happy-go-lucky seducers who had their way with the opposite sex. But the day came when they were forced to give this up. Someone corralled them into a relationship. They were encountering too much social hostility. They were getting older and decided to settle down. Whatever the reason, you can be sure they feel some resentment and a sense of loss, as if a limb were missing. We are always trying to recapture pleasures we experienced in the past. But the temptation is particularly great for the reformed rake or siren, because the pleasures they found in seduction were intense. These types are ripe for the picking. All that is required is that you cross their path and offer them the opportunity to resume their rakish or siren ways. Their blood will stir, and the call of their youth will overwhelm them. It is critical, though, to give these types the illusion that they are the ones doing the seducing. With the reformed rake, you must spark his interest indirectly, then let him burn and glow with desire. With the reformed siren, you want to give her the impression that she still has the irresistible power to draw a man in and make him give up everything for her. Remember that what you're offering these types is not another relationship, another constriction, but rather the chance to escape the corral and have some fun. Don't be put off if they are in a relationship. A pre-existing commitment is often the perfect foil. If hooking them into a relationship is what you want, hide it as best you can and realize it may not be possible. The rake or siren is unfaithful by nature. Your ability to spark the old feeling gives you power, but then you will have to live with the consequences of their feckless ways. The disappointed dreamer. As children, these types probably spent a lot of time alone. To entertain themselves, they developed a powerful fantasy life, fed by books and films and other kinds of popular culture. And as they get older, it becomes increasingly difficult to reconcile their fantasy life with reality. And so, they're often disappointed by what they get. This is particularly true in relationships. They have been dreaming of romantic heroes, of danger and excitement, but what they have is lovers with human frailties, the petty weaknesses of everyday life. As the years pass, they may force themselves to compromise because otherwise they would have to spend their lives alone. But beneath the surface, they are bitter and still hungering for something grand and romantic. You can recognize this type by the books they read and films they go to, the way their ears prick up when told of the real-life adventures some people manage to live out. In their clothes and home furnishings, a taste for exuberant romance or drama will peek through. They are often trapped in drab relationships, and little comments here and there will reveal their disappointment and inner tension. These types make for excellent and satisfying victims. First, they usually have a great deal of pent-up passion and energy, which you can release and focus on yourself. They also have great imaginations and will respond to anything vaguely mysterious or romantic that you offer them. All you need do is disguise some of your less than exalted qualities and give them a part of their dream. This could be the chance to live out their adventures or be courted by a chivalrous soul. If you give them a part of what they want, they will imagine the rest. At all cost, do not let reality break the illusion you are creating. One moment of pettiness and they will be gone, more bitterly disappointed than ever. The pampered royal. These people were the classic spoiled children. All of their wants and desires were met by an adoring parent, endless entertainments, a parade of toys, whatever kept them happy for a day or two. Where many children learn to entertain themselves, inventing games and finding friends, pampered royals are taught that others will do the entertaining for them. Being spoiled, they get lazy, and as they get older and the parent is no longer there to pamper them, they tend to feel quite bored and restless. Their solution is to find pleasure in variety, to move quickly from person to person, job to job, or place to place, before boredom sets in. They do not settle into relationships well because habit and routine of some kind are inevitable in such affairs. But their ceaseless search for variety is tiring for them and comes with a price. Work problems, strings of unsatisfying romances, friends scattered across the globe. Do not mistake their restlessness and infidelity for reality. What the pampered prince or princess is really looking for is one person, that parental figure, who will give them the spoiling they crave. To seduce this type, be ready to provide a lot of distraction, new places to visit, novel experiences, color, spectacle. You will have to maintain an air of mystery, continually surprising your target with a new side to your character. Variety is the key. Once pampered royals are hooked, things get easier, for they will quickly grow dependent on you, and you can put out less effort. Unless their childhood pampering has made them too difficult and lazy, these types make excellent victims. They will be as loyal to you as they once were to mommy or daddy. But you will have to do much of the work. If you're after a long relationship, disguise it. Offer long-term security to a pampered royal, and you will induce a panicked flight. Recognize these types by the turmoil in their past, job changes, travel, short-term relationships, and by the air of aristocracy, no matter their social class, that comes from once being treated like royalty. The New Prude. Sexual prudery still exists, but it is less common than it was. Prudery, however, is never just about sex. Prude is someone who is excessively concerned with appearances, with what society considers appropriate and acceptable behavior. Prudes rigorously stay within the boundaries of correctness because more than anything, they fear society's judgment. Seen in this light, prudery is just as prevalent as it always was. The new prude is excessively concerned with standards of goodness, fairness, political sensitivity, tastefulness, etc. What marks the new prude, though, as well as the old one, is that deep down they are actually excited and intrigued by guilty, transgressive pleasures. Frightened by this attraction, they run in the opposite direction and become the most correct of all. They tend to wear drab colors. They certainly never take fashion risks. They can be very judgmental and critical of people who do take risks and are less correct. They are also addicted to routine, which gives them a way to tamp down their inner turmoil. New prudes are secretly oppressed by their correctness and long to transgress. Just as sexual prudes make prime targets for a rake or siren, the new prude will often be most tempted by someone with a dangerous or naughty side. If you desire a new prude, do not be taken in by their judgments of you or their criticisms. That is only a sign of how deeply you fascinate them. You are on their mind. You can often draw a new prude into a seduction, in fact, by giving them the chance to criticize you or even try to reform you. Take nothing of what they say to heart, of course, but now you have the perfect excuse to spend time with them. And new prudes can be seduced simply through being in contact with you. These types actually make excellent and rewarding victims. Once you open them up and get them to let go of their correctness, they are flooded with feelings and energies. They may even overwhelm you. Perhaps they are in a relationship with someone as drab as they themselves seem to be. Do not be put off. They are simply asleep, waiting to be awakened. The crushed star. We all want attention. We all want to shine. But with most of us, these desires are fleeting and easily quieted. The problem with crushed stars is that at one point in their lives, they did find themselves the center of attention. Perhaps they were beautiful, charming, and effervescent. Perhaps they were athletes or had some other talent. But those days are gone. They may seem to have accepted this, but the memory of having once shone is hard to get over. In general, the appearance of wanting attention, of trying to stand out, is not seen too kindly in polite society or in the workplace. So, to get along, crushed stars learn to tamp down their desires. But, failing to get the attention they feel they deserve, they also become resentful. You can recognize crushed stars by certain unguarded moments. They suddenly receive some attention in a social setting, and it makes them glow. They mention their glory days, and there is a little glint in the eye, a little wine in the system, and they become effervescent. Seducing this type is simple. Just make them the center of attention. When you're with them, act as if they were stars and you were basking in their glow. Get them to talk, particularly about themselves. In social situations, mute your own colors and let them look funny and radiant by comparison. In general, play the charmer. The reward of seducing crushed stars is that you stir up powerful emotions. They will feel intensely grateful to you for letting them shine. To whatever extent they had felt crushed and bottled up, the easing of that pain releases intensity and passion, all directed at you. They will fall madly in love. If you yourself have any star or dandy tendencies, it is wise to avoid such victims. Sooner or later, those tendencies will come out, and the competition between you will be ugly. The novice. What separates novices from ordinary, innocent young people is that they are fatally curious. They have little or no experience of the world, but have been exposed to it secondhand in newspapers, films, books. Finding their innocence a burden, they long to be initiated into the ways of the world. Everyone sees them as so sweet and innocent, but they know this isn't so. They cannot be as angelic as people think them. Seducing a novice is easy. To do it well, however, requires a bit of art. Novices are interested in people with experience, particularly people with a touch of corruption and evil. Make that touch too strong, though, and it will intimidate and frighten them. What works best with a novice is a mix of qualities. You are somewhat childlike yourself, with a playful spirit. At the same time, it is clear that you have hidden depths, even sinister ones. This was the secret of Lord Byron's success with so many innocent women. You are initiating your novices, not just sexually, but experientially, exposing them to new ideas, taking them to new places, new worlds, both literal and metaphoric. Do not make your seduction ugly or seedy. Everything must be romantic, even including the evil and dark side of life. Young people have their ideals. It is best to initiate them with an aesthetic touch. Seductive language works wonders on novices, as does attention to detail. Spectacles and colorful events appeal to their sensitive senses. They are easily misled by these tactics, because they lack the experience to see through them. Sometimes novices are a little older and have been at least somewhat educated in the ways of the world. Yet they put on a show of innocence, for they see the power it has over older people. These are coy novices, aware of the game they're playing. But novices, they remain. They may be less easily misled than purer novices, but the way to seduce them is pretty much the same. Mix innocence and corruption, and you will fascinate them. The Conqueror. These types have an unusual amount of energy, which they find difficult to control. They're always on the prowl for people to conquer, obstacles to surmount. You will not always recognize conquerors by their exterior. They can seem a little shy in social situations and can have a degree of reserve. Look not at their words or appearance, but at their actions, in work and in relationships. They love power, and by hook or by crook, they get it. Conquerors tend to be emotional, but their emotion only comes out in outbursts when pushed. In matters of romance, the worst thing you can do with them is lie down and make yourself easy prey. They may take advantage of your weakness, but they will quickly discard you and leave you the worse for wear. You want to give conquerors a chance to be aggressive, to overcome some resistance or obstacle before letting them think they have overwhelmed you. You want to give them a good chase. Being a little difficult or moody, using coquetry, will often do the trick. Don't be intimidated by their aggressiveness and energy. That is precisely what you can turn to your advantage. To break them in, keep them charging back and forth like a bull. Eventually, they will grow weak and dependent, as Napoleon became the slave of Josephine. The conqueror is generally male, but there are plenty of female conquerors out there. Luandrea Salome and Natalie Barney are famous ones. Female conquerors will succumb to coquetry, though, just as the male ones will. The Exotic Fetishist. Most of us are excited and intrigued by the exotic. What separates exotic fetishists from the rest of us is the degree of this interest, which seems to govern all their choices in life. In truth, they feel empty inside and have a strong dose of self-loathing. They do not like wherever it is they come from, their social class, usually middle or upper, and their culture, because they do not like themselves. These types are easy to recognize. They like to travel. Their houses are filled with objets from faraway places. They fetishize the music or art of this or that foreign culture. They often have a strong rebellious streak. Clearly, the way to seduce them is to position yourself as exotic. If you do not at least appear to come from a different background or race, or to have some alien aura, you shouldn't even bother. But it is always possible to play up what makes you exotic, to make it a kind of theater for their amusement. Your clothes, the things you talk about, the places you take them, make a show of your difference. Exaggerate a little, and they will imagine the rest, because such types tend to be self-deluders. Exotic fetishists, however, do not make particularly good victims. Whatever exoticism you have will soon seem banal to them, and they will want something else. It will be a struggle to hold their interest. Their underlying insecurity will also keep you on edge. One variation on this type is the man or woman who is trapped in a stultifying relationship, a banal occupation, a dead-end town. It is circumstance, as opposed to personal neuroses, that makes such people fetishize the exotic. And these exotic fetishists are better victims than the self-loathing kind, because you can offer them a temporary escape from whatever oppresses them. Nothing, however, will offer true exotic fetishists escape from themselves. The Drama Queen. There are people who cannot do without some constant drama in their lives. It is their way of deflecting boredom. The greatest mistake you can make in seducing these drama queens is to come offering stability and security. That will only make them run for the hills. Most often, drama queens, and there are plenty of men in this category, enjoy playing the victim. They want something to complain about. They want pain. Pain is a source of pleasure for them. With this type, you have to be willing and able to give them the mental rough treatment they desire. That is the only way to seduce them in a deep manner. The moment you turn too nice, they will find some reason to quarrel or get rid of you. You will recognize drama queens by the number of people who have hurt them, the tragedies and traumas that have befallen them. At the extreme, they can be hopelessly selfish and anti-seductive, but most of them are relatively harmless and will make fine victims if you can live with the Sturm und Drang. If for some reason you want something long-term with this type, you will constantly have to inject drama into your relationship. For some, this can be an exciting challenge and a source for constantly renewing the relationship. Generally, however, you should see an involvement with a drama queen as something fleeting and a way to bring a little drama into your own life. The Professor. These types cannot get out of the trap of analyzing and criticizing everything that crosses their path. Their minds are overdeveloped and overstimulated. Even when they talk about love or sex, it is with great thought and analysis. Having developed their minds at the expense of their bodies, many of them feel physically inferior and compensate by lording their mental superiority over others. Their conversation is often wry or ironic. You never quite know what they're saying, but you sense them looking down on you. They would like to escape their mental prisons. They would like pure physicality, without any analysis, but they cannot get there on their own. Professor types sometimes engage in relationships with other professor types or with people they can treat as inferiors. But deep down, they long to be overwhelmed by someone with a physical presence, a rake or a siren, for instance. Professors can make excellent victims, for underneath their intellectual strength lie gnawing insecurities. Make them feel like Don Juans or sirens to even the slightest degree, and they are your slaves. Many of them have a masochistic streak that will come out once you stir their dormant senses. You are offering an escape from the mind, so make it as complete as possible. If you have intellectual tendencies yourself, hide them. They will only stir your target's competitive juices and get their minds turning. Let your professors keep their sense of mental superiority. Let them judge you. You will know what they will try to hide, that you are the one in control, for you are giving them what no one else can give them, physical stimulation. The beauty. From early on in life, the beauty is gazed at by others. Their desire to look at her is the source of her power, but also the source of much unhappiness. She constantly worries that her powers are waning, that she is no longer attracting attention. If she's honest with herself, she also senses that being worshipped only for one's appearance is monotonous and unsatisfying and lonely. Many men are intimidated by beauty and prefer to worship it from afar. Others are drawn in, but not for the purpose of conversation. The beauty suffers from isolation. Because she has so many lacks, the beauty is relatively easy to seduce, and if done right, you will have won not only a much-prized catch, but someone who will grow dependent on what you provide. Most important in this seduction is to validate those parts of the beauty that no one else appreciates. Her intelligence, generally higher than people imagine. Her skills, her character. Of course, you must worship her body. You cannot stir up any insecurities in the one area in which she knows her strength and the strength on which she most depends. But you also must worship her mind and soul. Intellectual stimulation will work well on the beauty, distracting her from her doubts and insecurities, and making it seem that you value that side of her personality. Because the beauty is always being looked at, she tends to be passive. Beneath her passivity, though, there often lies frustration. The beauty would love to be more active and to actually do some chasing of her own. A little coquettishness can work well here. At some point in all your worshipping, you might go a little cold, inviting her to come after you. Train her to be more active, and you will have an excellent victim. The only downside is that her many insecurities require constant attention and care. The aging baby. Some people refuse to grow up. Perhaps they're afraid of death or of growing old. Perhaps they're passionately attached to the life they led as children. Disliking responsibility, they struggle to turn everything into play and recreation. In their 20s, they can be charming. In their 30s, interesting. But by the time they reach their 40s, they are beginning to wear thin. Contrary to what you might imagine, one aging baby does not want to be involved with another aging baby, even though the combination might seem to increase the chances for play and frivolity. The aging baby doesn't want competition, but an adult figure. If you desire to seduce this type, you must be prepared to be the responsible, staid one. That may be a strange way of seducing, but in this case, it works. You should appear to like the aging baby's youthful spirit. It helps if you actually do. Can engage with it, but you remain the indulgent adult. By being responsible, you free the baby to play. Act the loving adult to the hilt, never judging or criticizing their behavior, and a strong attachment will form. Aging babies can be amusing for a while, but like all children, they are often potently narcissistic. This limits the pleasure you can have with them. You should see them as short-term amusements or temporary outlets for your frustrated parental instincts. The Rescuer. We are often drawn to people who seem vulnerable or weak. Their sadness or depression can actually be quite seductive. There are people, however, who take this much further, who seem to be attracted only to people with problems. This may seem noble, but rescuers usually have complicated motives. They often have sensitive natures and truly want to help. At the same time, solving people's problems gives them a kind of power they relish. It makes them feel superior and in control. It is also the perfect way to distract them from their own problems. You will recognize these types by their empathy. They listen well and try to get you to open up and talk. You will also notice they have histories of relationships with dependent and troubled people. Rescuers can make excellent victims, particularly if you enjoy chivalrous or maternal attention. If you're a woman, play the damsel in distress, giving a man the chance so many men long for, to act the knight. If you are a man, play the boy who cannot deal with this harsh world. A female rescuer will envelop you in maternal attention, gaining for herself the added satisfaction of feeling more powerful and in control than a man. An air of sadness will draw either gender in. Exaggerate your weaknesses, but not through overt words or gestures. Let them sense that you have had too little love, that you have had a string of bad relationships, that you have gotten a raw deal in life. Having lured your rescuer in with the chance to help you, you can then stoke the relationship's fires with a steady supply of needs and vulnerabilities. You can also invite moral rescue. You are bad. You have done bad things. You need a stern yet loving hand. In this case, the rescuer gets to feel morally superior, but also the vicarious thrill of involvement with someone naughty. The Roué. These types have lived the good life and experienced many pleasures. They probably have or once had a good deal of money to finance their hedonistic lives. On the outside, they tend to seem cynical and jaded, but their worldliness often hides a sentimentality that they have struggled to repress. Roués are consummate seducers, but there is one type that can easily seduce them, the young and the innocent. As they get older, they hanker after their lost youth. Missing their long-lost innocence, they begin to covet it in others. If you should want to seduce them, you will probably have to be somewhat young and to have retained at least the appearance of innocence. It is easy to play this up. Make a show of how little experience you have in the world, how you still see things as a child. It is also good to seem to resist their advances. Roués will think it lively and exciting to chase you. You can even seem to dislike or distrust them. That will really spur them on. By being the one who resists, you control the dynamic. And since you have the youth that they are missing, you can maintain the upper hand and make them fall deeply in love. They will often be susceptible to such a fall because they have tamped down their own romantic tendencies for